Today on Against the Grain, schools are underfunded, parents often struggle with long working hours and too little social support, but corporations and tech companies, awash in money and power, promise to entertain and teach children with a near infinite array of devices, apps, and products. Psychologist Susan Lin discusses how those who least care for children have so much influence over their lives. Marketing to kids through an avalanche of advertisements, collecting data about their private lives, and replacing their teachers in the classroom. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Living under capitalism, we're all the targets of corporations pushing an unending array of products. But children and teens are the especially vulnerable marks of tech companies and other unscrupulous corporations who profit massively off their lives with little oversight from the state. Corporations know that if they can build brand loyalty with kids, they're likely to remain customers for life. In Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children, Susan Lin discusses the high psychological, ecological, and social price that kids pay. Lin is research associate at Boston Children's Hospital and founding director of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, which is now known as Fair Play. Susan, let me ask you at the outset, what kind of play do kids need to grow and to thrive?
Beginning in infancy and going on through adolescence, children need hands-on, active, and creative play. They need to be able to play alone. They need to, as infants, explore the world with all of their senses. I mean, by the time they're teenagers, they don't need to taste everything. Probably by the time they're three or four, they don't need to taste everything the way that babies seem to. But they need to be able to explore the world. They need to be able to initiate their own activities. And they need to have the time, space, silence, and inspiration that, you know, allows them to create and to learn how to learn. I mean, that's what play is really all about. It manifests in different ways, you know, with, babies handle things and explore things. You know, older kids may start to build and then do creative play, to role play. They eventually can play games. It sort of goes on and develops in time. And it's really, you know, aside from love, kindness, critical thinking, it's really, you know, one of the characteristics of being human that I really value the most.
So then, in a nutshell, why do digital devices and the broader commercialized culture of children's products inhibit that kind of creativity and growth?
So again, you know, the reasons that they inhibit creativity change over time. For very young children, it's because, for one thing, they're two-dimensional. So they're not. They're not using touch, they're not using movement, you know, the kids. But another reason is that the purpose of everything just about that we can find online is not to promote healthy child development, it's to sell us and our kids things. That's the primary purpose. So a lot of what children encounter online is not about creativity. It's not about promoting critical thinking. It's about reaction.
So obviously, different children at different stages are going to be different. But if you were to assess the state of American children today, the The measures of well-being, how would you rate them? And perhaps you could place it in historical context. How well are children doing, and how well are they doing taking the longer view?
Kids are having trouble for all sorts of reasons, including poverty and hunger and a society that doesn't value public education. And so there's all sorts of reasons why I think children and are having trouble today. The Surgeon General, is so concerned about adolescents that he actually, issued a whole report on teenage loneliness. And, there's mounting research that, for teenagers, use of, and preteens, use of social media is a factor in depression, body shaming. It has been linked to suicides. So, that's an issue. And for younger children, they're not having opportunities to play creatively by themselves and with other people. And it begins in infancy. I mean, one of the most important experiences that we can provide for children is human connection. And that is, essential for mental health, the ability and the experience of connecting with humans. And learning takes place in relationship. And so, for instance, there's research showing that babies, for instance, can't learn anything from a machine. They can only learn from another human, which is, if you think about it, really quite wonderful. But the problem is that we have, these, zillion-dollar tech conglomerates that are doing everything they can to come between parents and children and actually to take over parenting. So what they want is for children to bond with their devices. They don't care so much if they bond with their parents. For instance, there's a device on the market that parents can strap onto their heads to hold a phone so that when they're changing a baby's diaper, the baby will look at the phone. And instead of looking at the parent and interacting with the parent, the baby, will bond, will look at the phone, and the phone, what the companies are advertising, this will make it easier to, diaper your baby. I mean, the devices are always marketed to parents as convenience, and they are falsely marketed as educational.
How do we get to this place where commercialism pervades every aspect of children's lives? Starting with the media, can you tell us about the way that children's television, which of course is now not the only source of media that children have, but how children's television was regulated and deregulated?
In the 1970s, there were all sorts of consumer protection laws passed, and there was a real interest in that, in protecting consumers from harm from corporate manipulation or advertising. And so in 1978, the Federal Trade Commission announced that it was going to ban marketing to children under the age of 8. And that was based on research showing that young children can't understand what a commercial is or how commercials work until the age of eight. Now what they're finding is it's actually not until kids are older that they can really understand that. And in any case, you know, even adults who know how marketing works are still incredibly susceptible to it. So the cognitive understanding, it can help, but it's not, you know, the be all end all. Anyway, so what happened after the FTC announced that they were going to do that is that every corporation that had a financial stake in marketing to children put enormous pressure on Congress. So that was the sugar industry, the food industry, the toy industry, to say nothing of the advertising industry and the media industries. So Congress actually defunded the Federal Trade Commission for a while and made it more difficult for them to regulate marketing to kids. And then in 1984, under Reagan, the Federal Communications Commission deregulated children's television, and it became fine to create a television program for the sole purpose of selling toys. So that's really the beginnings of where we are today. But as we know, what was happening in children's television was just one piece of this whole love affair with the market and turning to the market for solutions. It got more intense, corporate capitalism.
I'm speaking with psychologist Susan Lin. She's the author of Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, certainly, as you were saying, since the 1980s, the proliferation of products and media for children has just become ever more intense and really exploded in the last two decades. It's easy to talk about the way a technology might work that has a negative effect, but when you look at what has happened with the whole world of children, would you say that at its heart is technological change, or is it the business model of a commercial profit-driven business model that animates the companies that make the technology? How do you understand that?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, the new communication technologies are phenomenally powerful and persuasive. And, you know, we may look back on television and think that it's quaint, but television was an incredibly powerful persuader as well. But now, you know, we have these devices that, you know, kids can carry around all the time that collect huge amounts of data on all of us, and then can use that data to target all of us, including our children, specifically with advertising or with, you know, it's hard to even talk about just advertising anymore because the whole thing is an ad. Just everything that we encounter online just about is designed to sell us something. So the business model is a disaster for all of us. I mean, the business model it's a war for our attention, and companies will do anything they can to capture on our attention. And their goal is to keep us immersed in these technologies for as long as they possibly can, because that way we will be exposed to more advertising, which is how they make their money.
Many people know that their own data is being constantly gathered by websites and apps, but I think assume that there must be greater protections for children. How does it function for children? Are there protections that exist? And to what effect do they have? How much of children's private information is being scooped up?
A lot of social, media sites say that you can't get on unless you're over 13. But as we also know, there are huge numbers of children who are under 13 who are also on these sites. So the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which was passed in 1998, you know, prevents companies from taking personal information from kids who are under 13. It protects their privacy. But, you know, the problem is that it's very easy to lie about your age online. I mean, when I was writing my book, Who's Raising the Kids, I lied all the time online. You know, I said that I was a 4-year-old or an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, you know, so that I, you know, I could play, you know, these games and get into these sites. So it's very easy to lie about your age online. And so, you know, we have, you know, children, you know, young children, as well as teenagers, engaged in games and on social media, sites that are, you know, really, you know, terribly problematic.
The way that you see the effects of these apps and this digital world, and not just the digital world, also the toys and products that are being pushed toward children. What sort of values can we draw that are being perpetuated by this hyper-commercial world of products and screens and apps?
I want to answer that question because I think it's a really important question, particularly now. But I also want to say, because I get accused a lot of, you know, being anti-technology and a Luddite, although people don't really understand who the Luddites were. But
sure.
So I, you know, I just want to say that, you know, it's not that I'm anti-technology, although I'm wary of its power. But I use technology all the time. So it's not that I'm anti-technology. It is the business model, which you asked before. It is the business model that is terribly problematic. I worked in television. I worked on, you know, I was on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So, and other, you know, TV things. It's not that I'm anti-technology. The values in a commercialized culture, which is what our world is like today, and also, you know, especially what on the online world is like. Those values, these corporate values, they're not the values that children need, you know, to learn in order to thrive, for instance, in a democracy. So, you know, what are corporate values? What did they promote? Instant gratification, impulse buying, me first. You know, they don't want people to think. They want people to act and you know, to buy things without thinking. I mean, that's when I was in Korea a while ago. Coca-Cola had a campaign, and the actual campaign was stop thinking. So, and those aren't, those values are antithetical to democracy. So, you know, what are the values that you need in a democratic populace? You need critical thinking. You need to value critical thinking. You need to value kindness. You need to value altruism. And none of those values are beneficial to corporations, at least not financially. And they're not promoted by corporate tech or corporate media, which is pretty much all we have today. It's very hard to find online experiences for children that aren't selling them something.
And this kind of hyper-individualistic ethos that these commercial interests push often can take the form, since a lot of them are about promoting brands, is having children sort of end up embodying that and seeing themselves as a brand to be promoted in some way. I wonder if you could talk about that and what we know about how that outlook affects children psychologically, how they end up feeling about their place in the world.
There are a couple of things. I mean, social media is all about branding ourselves. Everything that is posted, that we post on social media, tells a story about ourselves and who we are. And, you know, a lot of, you know, deciding what you post has to do with how you want to come across. I mean, basically, so once we start, you know, using Instagram or posting on Facebook or TikTok or whatever, we become marketers for ourselves. And, you know, and one consequence of that is that the lives that we portray aren't really necessarily an accurate picture of what our lives are like. And one thing that that does in kids who use social media is to, you know, promote envy and dissatisfaction with their own lives because they compare themselves to other people. I mean, Instagram gives people who post pictures the opportunity to change their pictures to make themselves look better. And so even, you know, the pictures that you might see of your friends on these sites aren't even necessarily what your friends really look like. And so you're getting you're getting an as if experience. I mean, everything that's posted on those sites is curated and designed to, you know, project a particular image. It's not like having an intimate conversation with a friend.
How then does this world, which you say can be manipulated in all sorts of ways, how does it perpetuate stereotypes and bias which exist deeply in the larger society, but also deeply in these corporations?
Yeah, so when I was writing Who's Raising the Kids, I bought an Echo Dot, which is Amazon's speaker for Alexa, and I bought one for children, you know, because if I was going to write about it, I needed to see what they did. I needed to experience it. And around that time, there was, you know, some publicity about racism in search engines like Google. You know, a couple of books had been written about it. And so I woke up one morning and I thought, wow, I thought Alexa is a search engine. Why don't I go down and ask Alexa about race? So I went downstairs to my kitchen and asked the little Echo Dot. I said, Alexa, what are African-American girls? Because you have to ask a question like that. What are African-American girls? And Alexa said, African-American girls are the fastest growing segment of the juvenile justice system. And then I after I picked myself up off the floor and asked it several times because I couldn't believe what I was hearing, then I said, well, Alexa, what are African-American boys? And the answer was more garbled, but basically it said, you know, that African-American boys were either bad or stupid, that African-American boys have trouble learning, and I can't remember the exact words that it used. And The thing about Alexa, when I was talking earlier about how these tech companies want to take over parenting, the influence of parents, I mean, one of the things that Amazon does is promote Alexa as a tool to help kids with homework or to tell kids stories. But, you know, the data that all of these answers are based on, it's huge data. And so there's racism embedded in the data. And the only way that they could do something about that is if they really, you know, worked hard to make sure that the answers that Alexa was giving were not racist. You know, mostly they're not doing unless it gets called out and then they'll fix it.
Susan Lin is my guest. She's the author, among other books, of Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. This is Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. So even for parents who restrict or don't allow their kids access to screens, inevitably they get them in schools, a process which was greatly accelerated by COVID. And for quite a few parents, learning on screens seems more than acceptable. Can you tell us about the use of digital devices in schools and the role of big tech in promoting its products as educational?
Yeah. You know, there has, even before big tech was big tech, marketing in schools was a big problem for kids. I mean, you know, schools are public, you know, we don't value public education in this country. Schools are always, you know, short of money, teachers are overworked. And so so there's always been companies sponsoring school sports teams or, you know, donating gymnasiums, the Coca-Cola gymnasium and, you know, things like that. But with the tech industry, they really saw it as a way to get kids hooked on their brands. So, you know, you basically, and the younger the child, the more the thought was, the more hooked the child will be. And that's a marketing dictum, actually. You know, if you get a kid at birth, you'll have a child for the rest of that child's life. And lifetime brand loyalty is very valuable to corporations, including, you know, the tech industry. So, you know, so they started donating iPads to schools, for instance, even, you know, to get to kindergartners or Chromebooks are big, you know, in schools. And the problem with that, it's, first of all, especially for younger children, it's not a good way for them to learn. But also, you know, the Chromebook, you know, comes with access to all sorts of things that are problematic for kids. And what the research is showing is that, you know, in, you know, kids in schools who use, you know, these technologies a lot, you know, don't do as well as kids whose schools use them less.
Well, and sometimes the rationale with using them is that it allows for some kind of personalized learning, that technology allows teachers to teach to some children at a certain level and others at a different level who all might be in the same classroom. I wanted to ask you what you think of that, but also, since you just noted the kind of constant attack on public schools and on teachers, public school teachers, is there some dimension of this which is involved in sort of de-skilling and downgrading the role of the teacher in the classroom and replacing them with this technology to the benefit of these companies?
Yes, we don't, you know, just like we don't need parents, we have Alexa, You know, we don't need teachers, we have Google. I mean, that is, you know, maybe a slight exaggeration, but it's not untrue either. What I'm saying, that the tech industry, they really do want to have us turning to them, and our children turning to them for everything, including love. I mean, you know, now, you know, there are all of these online avatars that you can create, and they're being touted as, you know, helping you not be lonely, you know, or, you know, being your friend, things like that. I mean, the devices are really coming between us and our fellow humans, and therefore between us and our humanity. It's again, you know, when it comes to babies and young and very young children, really, there's no benefit to using a device. And there's, you know, increasing research that it's problematic for babies to use them, because, you know, what they're finding is that there are brain changes that go on with kids who are in front of screens a lot, and that the changes are in areas of the brain that affect critical self-regulation and executive function, which are two really important skills, first of all, for getting through school, but also for coping with life. And now there's behavioral research that shows, you know, the same thing. So, and you know, the problem is that for older kids and for adults, there are, you know, benefits to these devices. I mean, they can be used, you know, carefully and well, but the problem is, for, you know, for children, I mean, they don't have the cognitive wherewithal to really understand what's going on, but also because, you know, they're designed to be addictive, it's hard to let them go. And so it, you know, can blind us to what's going on in the rest of the world around us, in nature, for instance.
I wonder if you can talk about an example which you write about in your book, a supposedly educational app to teach children math in school called Prodigy. Tell us about Prodigy and why it's emblematic of the kinds of problems that these commercial technologies in schools create.
So Prodigy was marketed originally as a math app, that it would teach math to kids, including, you know, first graders, you know, the younger children as well as older children. And basically, it's like a combination of Pokemon and Fortnite and all of these games into this one app that, you know, claims to be, you know, teaching math. So first of all, they don't have research showing that it actually does teach math. I mean, there might have been a 1-point difference in scores on the testing. I haven't looked at it for a while. But the thing about Prodigy, aside from the fact that, you know, it's not a good way to teach math, is that it's what's called a freemium. These are very, very popular apps. So they start out being free, and they claim that you can play the game for free, but there's constant pressure to pay for an upgrade. And it's evident if you're playing Prodigy, especially if you're linked, you know, to other children, that the kids whose parents will pay for an upgrade can do so many more things. I mean, even, and this is, you know, seems like a metaphor, the kids who don't have an upgrade have to crawl, walk along on the ground where the kids who have an upgrade can fly. And so, I know, so it promotes envy. It, and the message is that math is so boring that it has to be embedded in a game, because otherwise it's so boring. And so, what the tech and the media industry does, and has in the media industry has done this for a long time, is send the message that learning is boring. And it has to be dressed up. It has to have singing and dancing and, you know, and all sorts of entertainment, but that actually learning is boring. And, you know, it's not. And kids aren't born thinking that learning is boring. If you watch babies and toddlers, they're completely invested in learning all sorts of things, learning, you know, not just, you know, how to walk, but how to make things work, how to do puzzles, how to hold a crayon, how to draw things. And they can work, you know, try over and over and over again until they succeed at something. And, all kids have that potential to engage with learning, and somehow we just kind of squeeze it out of them.
Well, not all of the companies that manage to market to children in schools are ones who are even framing it around education as such. I was astounded to read about the role of fossil fuel companies selling themselves. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, again, you know, this goes back to the way that we don't value public education. You know, a lot of schools have old textbooks, or, you know, what happens is that, you know, companies design teaching materials, sometimes whole curricula, to teach about things that actually they're harming. And the fossil fuel companies are an example of that, where, you know, they create materials to teach about ecology, or to teach about the environment and what can help the environment, or what's hurting the environment. And, you know, I, you know, did a lot of research into what these companies are producing, and they're very, very careful not to condemn themselves. So there are all sorts of problems about the environment, but fossil fuels are not one of them. Is essentially the message. And then, you know, if they make things for teachers and for students, it looks like, you know, aren't we generous? Aren't we doing a good thing? See how much we care about kids. But really, you know, what they care about is selling whatever the product is, and greenwashing their reputation.
I'm speaking with Susan Lin about her book, Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. Well, it sounds like what you're describing is a situation where the dislocations of our society in many ways provide fertile ground for corporations to sort of step in and promote themselves. So schools are underfunded, and then companies say, we're going to make donations of Chromebooks or iPads or tablets or curricula. But of course, they stand to benefit. These are not benign donations. Similarly, I wanted to ask you if some of the willingness of parents to provide their children with digital distractions of various kinds, you know, so much is dressed up as being educational, and I presume a lot of people don't actually know the extent of what is actually happening with their children's information and their children's experiences online. But I wanted to ask you if you think that some of the vulnerability of families to this corporate onslaught is connected to the lives of parents who work long hours, struggle often to make ends meet, and the line between home life and work life is often blurred. So they're bringing work home, or they're working from home, and handing their children off to this world is one way to be able to get things done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do write about that in Who's Raising the Kids. Yeah, because when you were talking about you know, schools and, you know, corporations, you know, donating materials to schools, I mean, they're basically market to parents in the same way. We can make your lives easier. You know, we know how stressed you are. And, you know, here's something that is, you know, educational for your child. And you know, so you get some time. And that's, you know, another example of, you know, corporations recognizing a flaw in our society, which is that we don't support parents. We don't have universal child care. You know, families are pretty much, if not actually entirely, on their own when it comes to raising their children. And so, you know, then, you know, here we have, you know, these tech companies marketing so-called educational videos. I mean, if you look, you know, go and look for, you know, videos for babies, they're all marketed. It's if it weren't so awful, it would be funny. Now the ones for babies are all marketed as sensory videos.
Isn't that a contradiction in terms?
Yes, it is. And, you know, so there are videos of colored balls and colored lights and companies that advertise how long this will occupy your infant or your toddler, or we can stop your baby from crying. And, you know, they can, but it comes at just an enormous cost, which is, you know, depriving children of opportunities to learn how to soothe and amuse themselves, and also, you know, training kids to turn to screens for stimulation and soothing. And there, you know, and the message to parents has been, your kids need to learn how to use these devices when they're very young, so that they'll be prepared for life later. They're going to need these skills. Well, first of all, when Steve Jobs was asked, what do your kids think of the iPad? His answer was, they've never seen it. So, you know, he, you know, clearly didn't want his kids messing around with an iPad, but he was fine with other children, other parents, you know, putting iPads in front of their kids. In fact, he wanted them to, because it was how Apple was making money. And you know, Apple, you can substitute Apple for Google or, you know, or whatever. So I just ache for parents today. I mean, in some ways, it's never been harder to be a parent. Parents are horribly stressed. They don't have the support that they need, and the culture is toxic. It's a real problem, and my heart goes out to parents raising children today. And then when, you know, if their kids, you know, end up getting addicted, or which of course we all are anyway, the parents are blamed. Well, they're bad parents. They're, you know, and it does come down to, people talk about a digital divide where, you know, low income kids don't have enough access to, you know, being online. Although now that something like 97% of teenagers have a smartphone.
That's astounding. I know that you ultimately argue that this is not going to be changed on an individual level, that the decisions of parents are not ultimately where this will change. But since we are talking about parents, you do say there's some things that parents can do. So let me ask you about that. What would you advise parents to do under these very difficult circumstances?
One thing that I would advise parents to do is to get involved with advocacy groups that are taking this issue on. Just, you know, sign up for them. I mean, the organization that I and some colleagues founded almost 25 years ago now, Fair Play, they're doing amazing work around this, and also provide a lot of tools and information for parents. So that is one thing that you can do. When it comes, you know, to your family, health organizations around the world recommend not putting babies and toddlers in front of screens, except possibly, you know, for video chatting with adults who love them. So think about that. Think about trying to limit your own time with screens, because, you know, your children learn from what you do, and do the best you can to limit the amount of time that your children spend with screens. I'm not saying that it starts out being easy, but I think that what parents are finding is that it's actually a happier household, because they're not constantly being nagged, you know, to, you know, put kids in front of screens. They're not being nagged by their children to do that, but also because the kids can learn to do other things besides be in front of a screen. I mean, and that's, as the screens become more powerful, as, you know, we're in this world with AI now, which is phenomenally powerful and, you know, unregulated, being able to recognize the difference between a screen and the rest of the world is going to be increasingly important. You know, try having one day a week or one night a week where you all put your devices away and do something together that's fun. Try to set times where, you know, none of you have a screen, like meal times. You know, if there's a way for you to have meals together, put your screens away and help kids learn how to enjoy talking or enjoy doing, you know, interacting with other people at meals and, you know, gain a lot of social skills that way. There are things that parents can do. And, you know, I will say, you know, that this is a societal issue. But another thing that parents can do is try to find other families who share your values, so your kids aren't the only ones without, you know, a smartphone by a certain age.
And then what about on the societal level? And, you know, as we wrap up the program, what can be done to rein in the power of, I mean, it's sort of a multiplicity of companies. And obviously at its core, this has to do with capitalism and the kind of very hyper intensified version that we have today. But what kind of regulation would make a serious dent?
basically, there are bills that pass the Senate and are currently stuck in the House, unfortunately, but they passed the Senate, that would significantly limit how corporations can target kids online. It would make being online a lot safer for children. But I don't want to leave people with thinking that this is completely hopeless and there's nothing that we can do. One extraordinarily piece of good news in you know what is can certainly be experienced as a kind of bleak time is that there is a growth in the movement to get smartphones out of schools. And schools all over the country are banning or limiting cell phones in schools. They're having the kids put them in a locker or in some kind of space, and many schools are doing this for the entire day. And this has just taken off in the past year. And that's really exciting. And interestingly, the kids are a lot happier as well. And suddenly, you know, the kids, instead of just being on their phones all the time, are interacting with each other. It's certainly cut down on online in-school bullying, which, you know, is a problem. So that's actually really hopeful. And that's another thing that parents can do is, you know, talk with your school or your school administrators about, you know, having rules that the kids can't use their smartphones in schools.
Susan Lin, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure. It was great talking to you.
I've been speaking with the author of Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. That's published by The New Press. You can find a link to it at againstthegrain.org. Susan Lin is a psychologist, ventriloquist, and research associate at Boston Children's Hospital. Her other books include Consuming Kids. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.